Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, several years ago, Seattle poet Tina Schumann was inspired to compile an anthology of memoir, essays, and poems by children of immigrants in the United States. Her mother emigrated to the U.S. from El Salvador in 1942. Schumann has said she really didn't know exactly what she was doing and was somewhat overwhelmed by the large number of contributions she received, but she persevered. The result is a work that reflects the many contradictions entailed in being and becoming an American. Two Countries, U.S. Daughters and Sons of Immigrant Parents, presents the work of 70 writers with immigrant connections. Poet Peggy Shoemaker calls it a brilliant, timely book, an antidote to divisiveness. The Elliott Bay Book Company hosted this reading on January 13th. Tina Schumann read from her introduction, followed by readings by contributors Shinyi Pai and Pragita Sharma. Here, Tina Schumann introduces the event.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out. I got to get a picture of everybody. Okay, say impeach. You all look gorgeous. Thank you. I always forget to do that. So, little background on how the anthology came to be. It's 7 years in the making. I think I sent out a call for submission in 2011. The germination of it had been, you know, with me all of my life, pretty much. My mom's an immigrant from El Salvador. She came here in 1942. And I had just always wanted to know what that experience was like for other people. My dad's German-Irish, born and raised in Jersey City, so he was an American. And I was raised in the Bay Area in Alameda and really went to a very eclectic school. You don't know these things when you're growing up. You just reflect on it. And so it, there was, you know, to go to school with kids whose parents, all parents, there were immigrants. We didn't question that. We just was who we were. And then you grow up and you look back and you go, oh, maybe that was kind of unique. And some of the experiences I had, you know, growing up with a mom who has an accent, one of the things I can remember is that when she had to encounter someone in the public, whether it was a bank clerk or grocery store, the minute they heard her speak, there was a transition in how they were going to deal with her. It was either fascination, I love your accent, where are you from? Or they started speaking slower and louder, because apparently she was deaf and she was stupid. So those were things you just noticed. It just was part of everyday life. And so I got many, many submissions. I could probably do a volume two of quality work about this topic. The main reaction from people was, thank you for asking. Finally, somebody wants to hear my story. And I wanted to make sure I took personal essays, flash memoir, and poetry. So there's 70 contributors. I don't think there's a clinker in the bunch. And I think that all the stories in here anyone could relate to. So I thought I'd just read a little bit of the introduction and then have my contributors read their work. When I was a child and strangers overheard my mother's accent, they would sometimes ask her, where are you from? Her standard reply was Central America. Unless the person asking was obviously another Latin, and then she would get specific with El Salvador. I understood from an early age why she did this. The assumption that a majority of native-born Americans often make when called upon to instantly visualize a foreign country, particularly a country they most likely knew little about, often resulted in stereotypical images pulled together from an amalgamation of several different Latin countries. It seemed to my mother that in the perspective of most Americans, El Salvador was identical to Mexico, and Mexico was interchangeable with Guatemala, Puerto Rico, Honduras, and so on. It took too much effort to enlighten someone on the spot, so why bother? My mother, Melida Luz Sol, was born in El Salvador's capital city of San Salvador in 1926. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1940 at the age of 14, when her single father, Narciso Sol, who worked as an importer with the United Fruit Company, suddenly died of a burst appendix. Her own mother had already immigrated to the United States and left her four daughters and husband in El Salvador, several years before when it became clear the marriage was disintegrating. My grandmother joined her sister Carmen, as well as other siblings and cousins already living in San Francisco in the late 1930s. Upon her father's death, my teenage mother and one of her older sisters, Dora Maria, made the trip gratis in the staterooms on the United Fruit banana boat. They traveled from San Salvador through the Gulf of Mexico and finally into the harbor at New Orleans, where they transferred to a train to make the 2-week-long trip to San Francisco. My mother would return to the country of her birth several times over the course of her life, as much of her family continued to live there. And if you want to hear the rest, you got to buy the book. So, Xinyi is first, and then Pragita Sharma, and I thank them both for coming out and for their stellar work. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. My name is Xinyi, and I'm a second-generation Taiwanese-American. My parents immigrated from Taiwan in the late 1960s, and they came to this country under sort of non-ideal circumstances. My father, at the time that he made his plan to leave Taiwan, was under a lot of pressure in that he had angered someone in a position of power in Taipei that resulted in his incarceration. And he had grown up in a period of Taiwanese history that's sort of known as the White Terror. So he and my mother were both born under Japanese colonial rule, which was then sort of superseded by the Chinese establishment and the government of Chiang Kai-shek coming in and declaring martial law in their country. So that's sort of the backdrop under which they sort of grew up in this sort of period of corruption and sort of historical trauma that was sort of characterize a period in which they grew up. So my father made the decision that he would come to the United States. He was able to borrow some money and to make some arrangements to be able to escape the situation that he was in. And he came to the United States as a graduate student, initially to the Midwest, to Kirksville, Missouri. And he had known my mother through the environment where they worked at a travel agency. And she came over a year later, and they married in a love marriage versus an arranged marriage. So I was born in the Midwest, but ultimately grew up in Southern California in Riverside, which is an interesting place. We grew up in a place called Highgrove. It was sort of the border of Riverside and San Bernardino counties, which is kind of a gritty place. Riverside, for me, it was a community where it was predominantly Latinos and African Americans, and there weren't other people that looked like us or spoke our language. And so it was a very unusual upbringing, sort of growing up in the shadow of like Los Angeles and that sort of cultural influence. So a lot of my work throughout the years has been very much about identity and sort of root searching. And as an adult, I've managed to make my way back to Taiwan, to my parents' motherland, to sort of understand their cultural history and legacy. And so this essay that I'm going to share with you is about my most recent trip to Taiwan with my aging father that I took in 2012. And most of my work as a writer is predominantly as a poet, and so this is a piece that I've never read out loud to anybody, so I hope you enjoy it. The Midwinter's Day. On Bagan Island in the Matsu Archipelago of Taiwan, my 71-year-old father insists on walking everywhere, as he did during his military assignment nearly 50 years ago. We retrace the path from Tangchi to Huao village, a trek that he made almost daily in 1964. The two villages were once connected solely by Baisha Beach, a long sandbar where crossing was made at low tide, but now a paved road and bridge connects the two centers. As we enter Huao, my father gapes in disbelief at the two-story houses lining the main road. At the time he left, villagers lived in primitive structures with straw roofs, dirt floors, and no electricity. At the eastern edge of town, we stumble upon the ghost house where my father was stationed as an officer. I set a bad example for other soldiers by rolling up my shirt sleeves and refusing to wear my cap, so I was transferred to the barracks up the mountain. The house has survived time, never razed nor rebuilt due to the villagers' fear of the ghosts that have haunted the property for over a century. We enter the structure through a portal where there was once a door, fighting wild grass and brush to get to the back room where my father once made his bed on a wooden board. The villagers congregate outside, curious to know more about the foreigners. "Do you remember me?" an old woman asked my father. My father has vivid memories of the family that lived next door to his haunted house. The young daughter of the family would haul crabs in from the sea and share her bounty with my father. What happened to the young girl who lived next door? The old woman shakes her head. It isn't her. She grew up to be a teacher and moved to Taipei. She's retired now. Another villager explains the government's subsidization of housing, which has allowed the town to modernize. I've always wanted to show your mother this place, my father says. I've come to Taiwan with my father for a reunion of the living, to visit his remaining siblings. My father is the only family member to have relocated to America. One after another, my cousins drive the aunts and uncles home to Qingshui, a small town on the central coast. At his fourth brother's house, my father receives his relatives over cups of oolong tea harvested from Alishan, while I thumb through tourist guidebooks and Skype my husband back in Seattle. The conversations between my father and relatives span health ailments, wayward children, bad son-in-laws, financial troubles, and the differences between life in Taiwan and abroad. A television broadcast news in the background of the Newtown shootings in Connecticut while relatives speculate on the circumstances that resulted in the shootings. He came from a broken home. His parents were divorced. His mother told him doomsday was coming, and auntie declares with absolute authority. A little over a year ago, our Taiwanese family embarked on a grave reorganizing project, bringing the remains of our ancestors together in one central burial site. Hired men dug up five plots and cemeteries scattered across the township, only to find that the bones at three of the graves had been pillaged. The bones of the missing include our relative from China that crossed the ocean to first establish my family in Taiwan. The ancestor is reputed to have been so filial that the only possession he crossed with were the bones of his parents strapped to his back. Now the rain hasn't stopped falling and delays us from visiting my grandparents' muddied graves on the hillside beside my uncle's house. So we head for what we hope will be better weather. Back on the Matsu Archipelago, we scale a small mountain to climb past barracks, abandoned cannons, and artillery training stations to arrive at the island's military museum. My father chats with visitor services staff and learns that the young soldier manning the desk attended college for engineering, but like all the other young men on the island, he's now putting in his obligatory time in the service. This kid's got it easy, my father mutters while pointing out a glass case that displays the kind of howitzer shell that rained down over Hu Ao during his assignment to the village. I brought one of those shells back as a souvenir for Grandma, but it kept getting rusty. We take a taxi southwest to the Wuxia Beihai Tunnel, a decommissioned military area that was carved out of solid granite by soldiers using pickaxes, shovels, iron rakes, baskets, and other tools. The building of the tunnel took 3 years, and the lives of over 100 soldiers were lost to careless blasting. My cousin Sujen's last words before we get on a plane to Matsu echo throughout my mind. There were so many men that never came back. As the tides rise, we hurry out of the cave, water lapping around our ankles. We leave Big An to fly to Taipei, where my father and I spend a few days touring heritage sites. On the northern coast, we make our way to Yaelio, where I beg my father to pose for a picture in front of Queen's Head Rock, recalling a black and white photo of my father from the 1960s. I want to recreate the moment. Overheated and uncomfortable, my father complains about all the Chinese tourists cutting the line. Around us, security officers outfitted with whistles sound their alarms anytime anyone gets too close to a rock formation or past the line of safety. After 20 minutes, my father has not stopped being sour. I finally take a picture. We spend the last leg of our trip on Ludao, Green Island. Neither my father nor I have ever traveled to the notorious island. Under martial law, 20,000 political prisoners from Taiwan were shipped off to Oasis Villa. Our relatives and friends can't relate to my curiosity. What's to see there? It's the dead of winter. You won't even be able to go snorkeling. The Tourist Bureau transformed the site of the former prison into the Green Island Human Rights Cultural Park, the first human rights memorial in Asia. A verse written by poet Bo Yang is inscribed outside the prison walls on stone. In that era, mothers cried night after night over their children imprisoned on this island. As my father and I tour the ruined buildings, we catch sight of workers sweeping the grounds. Inside the part of the prison that's been transformed into a museum, I enter a panopticon to walk down unending hallways of empty cells. At the end of one wing, I discover two padded cells without windows. My father translates the exhibition in the main hall, explaining the journal excerpts and drawings of those that were tortured and imprisoned. He grows somber, remembering the father of a classmate who was incarcerated for years on Green Island during the White Terror. A friend connects me to a Green Island local who takes us on a tour of the major sites. When Mr. Sun asks me what we want to see, I ask him, "Can you take us where the bodies are buried?" He agrees to drive my father and me to the cemetery outside of Swallow's Cave. We drive the car off a paved road and hike into a seaside area surrounded by wind-fallen trees. As we turn a corner into the graveyard, wild goats grazing in the cemetery scatter across the hills. My camera jams just as Mr. Tsun points into the distance and casually reveals that cave is where they buried the bodies. I discover later while reading a local guidebook that locals promote this myth, though it's untrue. But I sense my father's reluctance to disturb the spirits by walking too close to Swallow's Cave. One can't be too careful. I think about the gust of wind that blew my father off his electric bike when we arrived, the fragility of human life, my recent miscarriage. On Dongzi, a midwinter's day, the rain ceases and my body stops bleeding. Upon our return to Qingshui, my father and I hike up a hillside near sunset to pay our respects at the gravesite of his parents. My uncle leads us to the grave by memory, through wild grasses as high as our shoulders, full of bramble and thorn. The mosquitoes swarm. We make an offering of fruit and chocolate and return back home to dumplings, balls of dough eaten all over Taiwan on this day, in common households and in prisons, marking the passage of time and one more year. Thank you.
It's such an honor and privilege to read with Tina and Shinyi. It's just, that was a really powerful piece. Thank you. My name is Pragita Sharma, and the piece I contributed is I guess a lot of the content does sort of describe my parents' journey to the U.S., which my father came in 1969. He took a visiting professorship at MIT in mathematics, and my mother joined him, I think, 2 years later. And they now have a love marriage, but they started off with an arranged marriage. And I just found out this year that my mother would actually not like this, but that she's actually 5 years older than I thought she was. So when they had their arranged marriage, I think that everyone was told she was 19. But she was 24, and so it's very interesting to kind of think about. I think she was really pretty rebellious and really had a sense of her autonomy. And they've both taught me so much. Yes, they came from India, from Rajasthan. Actually, my father was a really stellar grad student, and I think the dean of the college in Palani, I guess that's in Jaipur, or near Jaipur, the dean of the college was my mother's uncle. And so he just kind of reviewed all the grades and who was a star wherever they, you know, in their field, and he kind of arranged it. My dad was very poor and came from a little village without running water, and my mother had means, and so that was always a tension that she kind of had more, and she would always say, "Your dad, my dad would be horrified too, I guess, but I loved them, and obviously I have affection for these, yeah, even, but my mom was like, "He looks so much better now that he's married me." She just kind of, so they're hilarious with I love the way they take care of each other. But the title of this poem is A Situation for Mrs. Biswas, and I was thinking of, obviously, V.S. Naipaul and how complicated his identity is, and his kind of colonial romance with his relationship to the West and of his South Asian identity and his Trinidadian identity, and the idea that in some way he has a kind of romance with his, and he's nostalgic about how he's sort of perceived. And I was raised loving Naipaul until I really spent too much time with his nonfiction, and I couldn't wrestle with his nostalgia. And my dad and I read the biography, and I think, I can't remember if it came out in 2008 or 2010. I don't know. Did anyone read that Naipaul biography, the authorized? So it was disturbing. It was very disturbing and difficult, and I kept trying to negotiate the problem of how Naipaul is experienced versus how much authority he wanted to have, and how they were in conflict. And so and I was thinking of a house for Mr. Biswas and the kind of problem of identity in that, and it and then I was kind of writing about a personal story. I was also teaching Howell at the time, and I had realized in teaching Howell and the book Howell on Trial that that poems are not legal documents. So that was really interesting to me, to figure out what could you put in a poem, what could be the truth of the poem that would not be disputed but would not be up for some scrutinized space, that would not endanger anybody involved. So that was kind of the point of this, and I think it will make more sense after I read the poem. A Situation for Mrs. Biswas. When I received the call, I was in a store in Missoula, Montana, a store stocked with sparkling ephemera, glass fauna, tiny belfry bulbs, winter white birch and stump lamps brandishing light cones, little shelves and branches hung with drops of ice and round silver baubles. I loved the store. It was cavernous, dark with wood and burlap, a ruddy brick loft with lithographs and monographs on birds or bracelets. The store owner, Fran, was away that day. Otherwise, I would have stayed in there a little longer. She was a comforting friend. She had impeccable taste, manifested in her put-together garments. She also had a warming, patient smile. I didn't stay long. I didn't linger, though linger is absolutely the wrong word. More like I didn't stumble around there for hours. I would stumble around in that store for a full year. If she had been behind the counter, I would have turned to her in bewilderment. You see, I'd picked up my ringing cell phone while browsing. I usually keep it off in stores. And my father said, "There's something I have to tell you. I don't want you to find out any other way. I'm leaving my job. They want me to resign." Fran had met my father the week before. He wanted to see downtown, the campus, get to know Montana. He had done research on the education opportunities. He was interested in outreach. People all over met him and found him to be a kind-hearted man. I had set up meetings. He was here to meet educators, mathematicians, more spirited people, I told him, than Bostonians. I told him the West was a magical place. He agreed. Later, he would tell me that this was his last best day, a strange pun on the last best place. Little did we know we would have to fight a very public battle. And apparently, from the rumors and from the strange treatment he received prior to his termination, there was a plot in place. We, as a family, felt the public ridicule. And as an Asian family, we felt the acute Asian shame. It was a dark, disastrous cloud, hanging, hanging, hanging. My father would be publicly shamed, and we were shocked at the racist narratives, allegations, a greedy brown man, mismanaging, mismanaging, mismanaging. One public interest story to release venom, to tease out real feelings from strangers. Blog comments were aggressive. The Indian was a con, a snake oil man. You just have to give them a scenario in which they can invest, in which to place those hard-to-place feelings. White people bury their resentments beneath their liberalism. We knew he hadn't done anything wrong. We knew this was bogus. Like I said, I was getting ready for the holidays. I played hooky that Tuesday, excited to wrap gifts. I wanted to decorate the house. This was my first house. My husband was out looking at Christmas trees. Albeit I'm a Hindu, trees are an awful lot of fun. And this planning was quickly thwarted with the difficult. My family was falling apart. The droop in my life felt permanent. I was more than 2,000 miles from my father, but the way he spoke at that moment of the call becalmed me. I felt anchored to his side. I will stay there for as long as it takes. Before this moment, I was in a terrific mood. I wanted to don the table with the kind of candles that beckoned, pulling you into an aesthetic presence, fully fabricated and lit, and yet looked like it came from snow. I'd been in Missoula for many months. I had come from Brooklyn, where I'd lived for 12 years. Now I was ready for escape. Having been born and raised outside of Boston, without the opportunities, say, someone like Robert Lowell had, I knew I was not of that ilk, nor was my father, now we realize. Boston was indeed for the rich, with its stodgy colonial identity, with its ridiculous Brahmins, its oddly culturalist stance, even with Harvard as its mirror, even with Cal as front and center literati. Even so, I was pleased. I was unhurried in my new life. I was. I could feel how I stood. I could feel the rising happiness of the belly, not the gut. I was consumed with a bliss of poetry, so much poetry around me, everything with poetry. I said and understood the workshop will be my ideology, my intentional community, front and center with bells. My family was overjoyed with the way our lives were working together. My father was comfortable, my mother pleased, a professorship and presidential position at a college. He was the first South Asian president. He'd come to America with very little and now had something. As you can see, there is an immigrant narrative here. When he first arrived, he made very little money as a visiting professor, so he worked security at night at the Museum of Fine Arts. He kept thinking his colleague Bruce was calling him bastard when he was calling him Buster. It took him months to realize this. He first had to confront Bruce. The sequence of his first major purchases and acquisitions, which took several months, a suitcase and a rug. Then he found a dentist chair for the living room. He bought the Bob Dylan album that had Blowing in the Wind because it really sounded Hindu. It sounded like it came from the Rig Veda. For many years, I would say he was a model minority. He aspired to being rewarded for his good work by white people. We agreed all was well. I had made my way to where I had wanted to be, living a poet's life, and it felt extraordinary. All of the birch stump lamps lighting up inside, this was a kind of bliss. I had arrived where I loved in absolute terms, where I could love the poetics of if, then, and thou, the luminous. And yet poetry haunts with suggestions that terrible things are true and stick. As Rilke says, I am much too small in this world, yet not small enough to be, to you, just object and thing, dark and smart. The sun was hidden behind the darkest cloud. I said, what is happening to my father? In response, my husband's back gave out. He could not walk without whimpering. There was whimpering in the night, and I wasn't sure which one of us it was. What was happening to my ableness? We had failure, heaps of failure in our hands. The world had recast itself in such a way that I had to address the power behind it. I kept saying strange things to people like, no one is exempt from suffering. I felt like a tiny bird with sinking feet. There were assertions about difference that I had not wanted to make in the past, but now did. Where was I? Who was I? My father was told he had to watch his back, and then they took everything away from him. To take away his dignity with so many untruths, did I have to watch my back too? What did I think I could have? I wasn't even sure if I had it here. People hadn't seen me as me. I started to feel it. Those glass birds and the birch lamps were a kind of privilege. Only others could have, not others in the sense in which I was other. I started to see how money worked the room, when we had it, when we didn't. Imagine we were so close to the soaring sky, and imagine how we fell, how we knew falling wouldn't end us. Fall right here, fall right there, cry out, oh blustering self, it couldn't be as bad as you think. I said, let's remember how to do it so it won't hurt this time or the next. But I had to say the branches extended their arms. There was a house attached to them. We found ourselves languishing, then needing to rebuild. It was the turning of the year and then another one. And the showy, extravagant people capped themselves on the tops of mountain ash. We came out to clear them away. I'm just going to end with one little poem. It's just because my dad said, I'm better now. Could you please just write something to resolve this poem? So I was just reading, The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. And he has a line called this quote. It is one thing to be cosmetically defiant of authority by wearing unconventional clothes, what social scientists and economists call cheap signaling, and another to prove willingness to translate belief into action. And I was worried that I employed cheap signaling in my poem, which is like a whole other conversation about narrative kind of symbols. And I worried that he felt exploited by my telling his story and that it was shaming. And so I wanted to kind of just address that, and then I'm kind of done. But so this is after writing Under Gloom, and after that idea of she did not want to embody cheap signaling. That's the title. In poems from her book, she did not want to import a code of signals that took her father's voice solely for her imperatives, in which they appeared as grenades, taglines, or hashtags. And however she declares Missoula as a Western town, a city in which she struggles to belong, its wilderness of towering, the sighted and yet spindly pines, with their melancholia points of dry brush and iron-designed trunks, alongside ruined bridges drowned in solid ice. She realized she was losing people who quietly judged, or not so quietly, and who believed too solidly in their false benevolence, candy nurses and their do-good harm, yet she learned how to deliberate under a sky big enough. 2. Now her family is far from distress and a saddle of their own inheritance, immersion into a wholesome exaltation, everything light and interconnected. What made her father's otherness a painful recognition also made him a star witness to the truth of his own becoming, to his faithful and long-buried Hindu self, now emotive force, far from untoward epistemic arrogance, hidden in the language of authorial tumult. She moved from the confession to narration in order to construct an affect of irregularity so she could reckon with the affable truth of black swans and feelings of too many white ones and the torpor resting in their probability. Thanks.
Thanks for streaming this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. The Elliott Bay Book Company hosted this reading on January 13th. Tina Schumann read from her introduction, followed by readings by contributors Shinyi Pai and Pragita Sharma. Tune in again soon.